Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this October 2009 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's diversion, Jim Campanella. After last month, I didn't think any listeners would be writing to me for quite a long time with science questions, so I was a bit surprised when in the last month two more listeners emailed me. They both had questions or observations that were so interesting that I felt I should share them with everybody out there. In addition to answering those questions, I will throw in a couple of bonus stories for you guys tonight, so hold on to your seats and let's get going. I will not identify the first listener by name because I do not want to embarrass them. They emailed me essentially saying that their brother was a big believer in conspiracy theories and that he insists that there is no way that the H1N1 virus, also known as the Mexican swine flu, could exist in nature without the intervention of humans. Let's call the brother Homer, for lack of a better name. Homer says that there is no way that a virus can naturally have chicken, human, and pig DNA in it. Homer's sibling appealed to me to bring the light of reason to his eyes. I'm not sure I can do that, but I can certainly answer the question. First, viruses have been picking up DNA from hosts for millions of years. That's what they do. The worst offenders are the nasty retroviruses, like HIV or herpes. They can do this because retroviruses insert their DNA into the host DNA. That's your chromosomes. They do this to hide from the immune system, and it works great. We have yet to cure any viral disease, let alone a retroviral type. So then at some later date, the virus DNA pops back out again when the virus wants to continue its rampage of terror through your cellular system. Well, when the virus DNA pops out of the host DNA, it very often brings along DNA from the host. That DNA becomes incorporated into the viral DNA and becomes part of the viral genome after that point. Viruses are the ultimate scroungers, and the fact that they pick up DNA from their hosts makes them even harder for the animal immune system to recognize and fight off. Again, this is something that viruses have been doing for a very long time. How do I know this? Well, here's an example I actually use in my genetics classes. 70 years ago, or so, it was discovered that certain viruses can cause cancer in animals. The simian sarcoma virus was the first one discovered. It causes monkey tumors. When we finally got the technology in the last 30 years or so to start to sequence DNA, we found that there were certain genes in these viruses which were responsible for inducing tumors. These were called oncogenes, literally cancer genes in Latin. Well, for a while, researchers were thrilled, thinking they had found the source of cancers in animals. They figured the cancer must be caused by a viral infection, at least in animals. At that point in history, they still hadn't found a virus that caused human cancers yet. But here's the crux of the story and the point I am making. A short time later, they discovered those same oncogenes in tumor cell DNA of animals. Researchers hypothesized that the virus infected the animal and inserted the oncogene. But further study showed that this was wrong. The oncogenes were already there. They were all over the genome of the monkeys and other animals, in fact. It turned out that oncogenes were simply good genes in animals that had gone rogue and no longer obeyed growth controls anymore. And here's the key point. The viruses did not bring the oncogene DNA to the host. On the contrary, the oncogene DNA had been picked up over thousands of years of evolution with the host. So the animal DNA had become part of the virus over a very, very long period of time. Okay, that long drawn out point was number one. Here's number two. Now, Homer, think about this. When was the last time you heard about a flu virus coming out of London or Paris or New York or Toronto for that matter? I could keep this up, but do you see where I'm going? New strains of flu virus rarely develop in these so-called first world countries. Why? Well, to put it very simply, because we are no longer close to the land in the first world. I don't mean that there are not farms and farmers, but farmers and farms in the developed world are much more separated from the land. You will not likely see a farmer in Iowa with livestock wandering around his house. Chickens and sheep and goats and pigs and humans are isolated from each other in the first world, especially if they are sick. If a pig gets sick in Iowa, the first thing the farmer does is isolate the pig from the other pigs and animals and bring in the vet. If a pig gets sick in the developing world, it is not unknown for the farmer to bring it into his home and try to care for it. After all, you're talking about a big investment for a poor family. It is common for viruses to jump barriers between species, and usually the likelihood of this barrier jumping depends on how often the one infected species is exposed to a second. The more often it's exposed, the more likely the jumping from species to species is to happen. This is why that barrier jumping seldom occurs in developing countries. We keep our animals separated, especially when they're sick. That separation does not occur, again, in the third world. Now, given all that info that I've just gone on about, imagine this scenario. A Mexican farmer has a pig infected by a flu virus. He brings it into his house to care for it. In his home are also chickens. The virus infects the chickens. The virus already has DNA from the pig incorporated into it for the last 100 years of pig infections. Now, the virus just needs to jump to the human, which isn't that hard since it was already a mammalian virus. By the time the virus has gone through a whole series of human hosts in Mexico and the US, and it's finally sequenced, it's pretty likely it will have picked up human DNA into its genome. Virologists have seen this so often, they even have a name for it. They call it a triple reassortment strain. Heck, there are even some researchers who are suggesting that the double reassortment strains with bird and pig DNA have already been around for years, so that it was just a simple recent jump into humans that brought us to our present state. Now, if we apply Occam's razor to this problem, we can decide what is more likely. Occam's razor, as you may remember, is the scientific principle which suggests that you always use the simplest explanations for an observation before you start making complicated ones. Is it more likely that this was a natural phenomenon along the lines that virologists have seen for years, or that it was cooked up in a lab somewhere? Let me put it to you this way. If it was cooked up in a lab somewhere using genetic engineering, it's a pretty crappy virus. The death rate in developing countries has been pretty low, not really that much higher than any flu from the last few years. So if this was purposely engineered, the mad scientists weren't very good at their trade. They certainly could have made it more deadly to life and limb. Homer, I leave it up to you to decide. You may want to read Introduction to Modern Virology by Nigel Dimmick. You can pick it up cheap on Amazon. It's a great basic introduction to how viruses interact with their hosts. Or, there's a great article in the New England Journal of Medicine from June of this year that describes the genetic analysis of H1N1 and its possible sources. The article was written by the whole H1N1 virus investigation team, and that is 30 or 40 researchers. And if they don't know what they're talking about, nobody does. In addition to that, an article in the New England Journal of Medicine from July of this year, 2009, from the lab of Vladimir Trifonov at Columbia University, actually tracks all the other strains going back to the early 1990s that H1N1 is related to. So seriously, this virus did not just come out of thin air. The second question of the night comes from Jesse Willis, whom some of you may know as being the moderator of the fantastic science fiction and fantasy audio website. Jesse emailed me and wanted to know if I had ever discussed plastics on this show and the serious threat they pose to the world. No, he was not talking about those little microplastic bits that are floating in the ocean and creating havoc there as pollutants, though that is a very serious issue. He was referring to the problem with bisphenol A-type plastic, usually just called BPA. For the last several years, BPA has been suspected of being an endocrine disruptive agent. That means it has the ability to mimic endocrine hormones and act like them, specifically estrogen. It has been proposed by several scientists around the world, including Dr. Eva Bonefeld-Jorgensen of the University of Aarhus in Denmark, that BPA has become a serious pollutant across the entire world. It may be one of the causes of worldwide sperm counts dropping in men over the last 30 to 40 years. It may also be a reason that pre-adolescent girls are physically maturing more quickly than they have in the last 30 or 40 years. Readers of Popular Science may even remember in an article from several months ago that there are researchers who suggest that BPA may be responsible for weight gain in the developed world. BPA is everywhere, unfortunately. Plastic water bottles, milk bottles, baby bottles, microwave containers, and it does have a real effect. And for once, the worry wards may have it right. There are more than 125 studies funded by government agents, such as the National Institute of Health, documenting that BPA has a wide range of effects, including structural and neurochemical changes throughout the brain associated with behavioral changes such as hyperactivity, learning deficits, increased aggression, and increased likelihood of drug dependency. Of course, there are also abnormalities in sperm production in males and oocytes in females, disruption of hormone production and fertility in both males and females, immune disorders, increased growth rate, and early secondary sexual maturation. Does that sound safe? I don't think so. You would think there would be an outcry, and there has been, but really not enough of one. Even the U.S. FDA is not to be trusted on this. Approximately 7 billion pounds of BPA are produced annually, with more than 2 billion pounds produced in the U.S. Worldwide, BPA generates an estimated $1 million a day in revenue for corporations such as Bayer, Dow Chemical, General Electric, and Sunoco. In May of 2008, the FDA released a report indicating that currently marketed foods containing BPA are safe, and the exposure to BPA from foods, including exposure for infants and children, are less than the levels that may cause health effects. Okay, that sounds reasonable, but there was a bit of a problem with this. The report sparked concern among scientists and consumers regarding conflict of interest, not disclosed by FDA's BPA subcommittee chair, Martin Filbert. This following a $15 million grant from Dow Chemical for the University of Michigan Risk Science Center, which Dr. Filbert founded and co-directs. Oh yeah, that says a lot about the safety of BPA. Embarrassing to those of us from the States, a six-month Canadian review of 150 research studies resulted in findings contradictory to the FDA. The Canadian health minister announced that there is concern for newborns and infants. And Canada is the first country to declare BPA a health hazard and to take steps to ban it from products. A number of retailers have stopped using BPA products. Walmart and Toys R Us are no longer stocking baby bottles and other products that contain BPA. In April 2008, Nalgene, a maker of hard plastic sports water bottles, began phasing out production of its outdoor line of polycarbonate containers that include BPA. Playtex also announced in April 2008 that it will produce products that are BPA-free, and products can now be identified by a BPA-free icon listed on their products. Both Dow and Playtex have downplayed any risk with BPA, but cited the reason for the BPA-free products was due to consumer response. So where does this leave us? I'm not sure. I know there are a number of state-sponsored bills across the United States that are trying to ban BPA plastics. The public is just beginning to realize that BPA is bad and just how bad it is. Sure, BPA plastic in contact with food is bad, but what happens after the BPA plastic is discarded? Well, that's the other half of the equation that is seldom mentioned. BPA leaching is a serious concern. Because of leaching, not only is BPA present in plastic and metal products, it's also present in the air and in drinking and other water sources. BPA leaches from the soil into fresh water, and because of plastic and metal waste disposal, it's a major contaminant in landfills. By the way, the recycle code for BPA-containing plastics is 3 and 7. You may want to avoid those. Not to be a predictor of doom and gloom, but the human race will be facing a serious problem in the next 50 years. United Nations experts in demography and population genetics in a recent report are predicting that by 2050, the human race will hit a maximum population of about 9 billion. Which, by the way, is well below the theoretical carrying capacity of the Earth of about 11 billion. After that, the numbers of humans on this planet will begin to drop. This is partly due to social pressures to keep population down, but also trends in human fertility that are, to say the least, alarming. The Malthusian model suggested that the human population would just keep increasing and increasing until a crisis point. Well, it appears that Malthus and Harry Harrison and Isaac Asimov were all wrong. If we're not careful, we may end up with the horrible scenario presented in P.D. James's apocalyptic novel, Children of Men. In his story, the Earth has become scourged by infertility and an aging adult population. This is already happening in places in Europe and Asia. Japan is actually paying couples to have extra babies. It's predicted that by 2050, Japan's aging native population will fall to levels not seen since the 1500s. Japan is so terrified they have even created a new government ministry to reverse this decline. The problem is already affecting several European countries, including Germany, which is closing hundreds of grade schools a year, and even Russia, which is paying couples $9,000 per child because they are so worried. The only reason that the U.S. has not felt any of these problems is our progressive immigration policy. Our population here grows because we are constantly getting new and sometimes more fertile citizens from the developing world. However, if you look at the Native American population, it has been falling for decades, and the impact has already been felt economically. Even the Hawaiian Native population has been affected. There are only about 15,000 pure-blood Native Hawaiians left in the world. For those of you who scoff and say China will continue to have billions of people just by itself, let me remind you that the communist government policies there limit children severely to just one per couple. China is winning its anti-population struggle, but at what cost? I have wandered a bit on my point, but where am I going with this? It's this. BPA is not helping our downward population spiral. All that we can hope as a species is that BPA is the only chemical fertility threat on the horizon, and that no others emerge very soon, or we all may be in very serious trouble. The next story of the night is a seriously strange one. The brain is an amazing thing, and we take it for granted sometimes that what we consider reality actually is real, and that what we are seeing is actually there. This is the entire basis of stage magic. It works because we have programmed expectations about how the world works. What happens when brain damage leads to an alteration in your worldview? I know this sounds like the proposal of some horrid television show on ABC, a la the hopefully now canceled Eli Stone, but I am talking about something real and documented here. And this cleanly falls into the Oliver Sacks territory. Dr. Burkhard Kasper of the University of Erlangen in Germany and his associates report in the August 2009 Journal of Epilepsy and Behavior about the first instance of a brain seizure making someone believe that they have undergone a sex transformation. Kasper reported a 37-year-old woman admitted to an epilepsy center in Germany for seizures in 2006. She described having nausea, fear, and sometimes deja vu several times a week. Even more bizarre, she reported occasionally also perceiving the following delusion. Quote, "I sometimes no longer feel I am female. I have the impression I have transformed into a male. My voice, for example, sounds like a male voice at that moment. One time, when I looked down at my arms during an episode, they looked like male arms, including male hair growth." Unquote. Okay, so you're thinking, oh my gosh, how bizarre. Let's go one step further. Her illusions were not limited to herself. She also saw nearby women as becoming men too. Quote, "One time, another woman, a friend of mine, was in the same room. I perceived her as becoming a male, including the changing of the sound of her voice." Unquote. Prior to her delusions, the woman was completely healthy, with no history of other mental disorders. According to Kasper, she never experienced a similar phenomenon outside of the seizures. Eventually, anticonvulsive drugs relieved her of the delusions and most of her other symptoms. So why did she have these delusions? Well, MRI scans revealed a benign tumor in the woman's brain that was apparently linked with the seizures. The tumor is located in the right amygdala, with irregular activity seen in the surrounding right temporal lobe. The amygdala, near the center of the brain, seems to play an important role in processing human identity, including aspects like familiarity, emotional state, and sex. And past studies revealed that electrical stimulation of the temporal lobe triggered doubt about sexual identity. Probably the most important conclusion of the study is that there are now brain circuits that are directly linked with perception of gender. Kasper is now working on MRI tests to determine how well a person can distinguish gender, to both analyze this patient and potentially others. This may be particularly useful in better understanding both men and women with gender dysphoria, in which they perceive themselves as the opposite gender of their physical body. Okay, last story of the night. And it involves, yes, ants again. I may change the title of my sofa spot here to the Ant News Update, if I continue this trend. I'm not sure anybody will like that, but I certainly find it interesting. I'm kidding. As we've discussed about previously, ants see the world in a rainbow array of scents. The scents of their nest mates, both live and dead, and tempting food. It was assumed for a long time that when an ant follows a plume of scent to a tasty snack, it was following a smell that it learned to associate with the food's odor. It turns out that ants apparently can learn to associate a smell with a food simply because they like the smell, and not necessarily because it has been associated with food. Dr. Yael Proveco and Roxana Yosens from the Universidad de Buenos Aires, Argentina, reported this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology on a study that examines whether ants can learn to recognize food flavors picked up when sipping from a nestmate's mouth, and then follow the flavor's smell or odor in search of more of the same. Provenco and Yosens tested their theory by seeing whether an ant could follow an odor in a maze after tasting the scent in sucrose supplied by a foraging nestmate. Having marked an ant that would feed from a full forager, the team paired the hungry ant with a forager. Then they released the forager into an area supplied with tea tree flavored sucrose solution. They followed the forager to fill up on the tea tree flavored sucrose and return it to its nestmate so that the hungry ant could take a sip of sucrose from the forager's mouth. Then they asked the just fed ant to choose between a tea tree scented channel and a chemical channel with rose smell in it that the ant had not previously encountered in a Y-shaped maze. The ant successfully chose the tea tree scent, and when the team repeated the test with other pairs of ants and different scent combinations, the insects that sipped flavored sugar were always able to follow the flavor's scent. So rather than simply following the tempting odors to tasty treats, ants can learn to recognize scents associated with food that have been brought to the nest, allowing new foragers to follow the scrumptious scent and forage for more. Well, that was quite a bit, and that's all from me for now. As always, take care, stay away from BPA plastics, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.